This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Margaret Kimberly says the Democrats would rather lose elections than break with the 1%. Dr. Anthony Monteiro says the age of European domination of the world is coming to an end. And Mumia Abu-Jamal recalls the bad old days of the 60s in Philadelphia. But first, Obamacare remains in a kind of limbo in the U.S. Congress, having been repealed in the House, but with no action pending in the Senate. On the single-payer health care front, a majority of House Democrats have finally signed on to Congressman John Conyers' Medicare for All bill. However, Democratic Party leaders have not gotten behind the measure, and Bernie Sanders has not introduced a single-payer bill in the Senate. In Chicago, we spoke with Dr. Susan Rogers, a board member of Physicians for a National Health Program.
I think that it's just politically difficult for a lot of these congressmen to take a stand for single payer, although clearly they cannot support the bill that has been passed in the House now. And even the Affordable Care Act, many people know that there are some significant issues with that. There's some positives, clearly. The fact that, you know, people can get covered for pre-existing conditions, kids can stay on their parents' policy till they're 26. But it doesn't eliminate the whole issue of private insurance sponsored health care, which is that's the biggest problem. That's where all the high deductibles are coming from, the copays, the tiered drugs, and all of these expenses that are being shifted to patients that the Affordable Care Act does not fix.
I was surprised to see even a Republican seem to admit that single payers' time has come. That person was defending the Republican bill that would allow states to opt out or opt into plans. And this congressman mentioned that so they could have their single payer or they could have our plan, which seemed to be an admission that single payer is on the horizon anyway.
That is true. I think a lot of people will say that. However, to have just a small segment of the population in a single payer system won't work, because that's been the problem with the public option, is that the people who would end up being in the public option are people who couldn't get affordable insurance elsewhere. So here you've got a pool of people who have a lot of medical issues, who are high cost. And that's why that public option or small single-payer system would not work. I mean, if you look at Medicare, it covers everybody over 65. And we all know that's a very heterogeneous group in terms of health. You've got some people who are very, very healthy. Some people are high utilizers of health care. So that's why that pool works, because you've diluted the risk, because you've got healthy people and sick people in that pool. And that's the way a single-payer system would work. Everybody has to be in it.
Single-payer seems to work in every industrialized country in the world, but folks in the United States, Democrats as well as Republicans, act as if the U.S., the richest country in the world, can't afford it.
Well, we still have this assumption that healthcare is a commodity and that the market should dictate how it functions. Buying healthcare isn't like buying a car. Everybody needs the same coverage in healthcare. Everybody doesn't need the same kind of car. Everybody doesn't need the same kind of house. So that's where the market comes in, is when people have choices with things. But people talk about choice of healthcare, which really, when you think about it, makes no sense. Do you know what your healthcare needs are going to be next week? You have no clue. You assume they're going to be what they are today, but you don't know. That's the whole point of insurance, is to cover you for the unexpected. So to make buying health insurance a matter of choosing what's best for you, that whole basis is false. It's not applicable, because you don't know what you're going to need. So you have to be covered for everything. And that's why people end up being exposed to these phenomenal bills, these high deductibles, these copays that send them into bankruptcy.
And the net result is that the United States pays more per capita for health care than anybody else in the world without insurance for everybody.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And an interesting part of that number, too, is that the majority of those dollars are already government dollars. So the government is already paying the majority of that per capita expense, not just Medicaid, not just Medicare, but in terms of the premiums for government employees, all teachers, all policemen, all firemen, all these people get their health premiums paid for with government dollars. And then when you look at the tax write-off by employers for what they spend, that's an additional cost to the government. So the government is already spending more than other countries already, without the additional cost of what they're putting on patients and saying that they have to have the so-called skin in the game. So the government is already paying more than everybody else. So the whole idea that there isn't money is not true. We would save so much money by eliminating all the administrative costs. It's ridiculous, the amount of time and money that gets spent in administrating a system like this that is so complex and so tedious that it's difficult. And even me as a physician who had some medical issues this last year, I found it difficult to navigate this system. So I can't even imagine how someone who does not understand healthcare can figure a way through it. It's impossible.
So it's not a question of expense, which is already exorbitant, but who gets paid and who profits?
That is exactly true. And the ones who are going to get paid are the health insurance companies. There's no question. And I mean, if you look at a large hospital, I bet they've got more billing clerks than they do nurses per patient. That just tells you where the money is going. It's not going to healthcare. It's going to billing. And if you look at the electronic medical record, which was supposed to be developed to make healthcare better, so that if you go to a hospital in New York and then see somebody in California, they should be able to talk, but they don't. All it does, it was really driven by billing. It was not driven by a need to improve healthcare or clinical care. It was driven by a way to bill. And that's the whole concept. So it really isn't helping healthcare. It may be a little bit because we can read the notes now versus, you know, physicians' penmanship before, but it's not lowering medical costs. In fact, it's driving it up.
As a physician, as a person, as an activist medical person, what would you like to see happen to get the Congress off the dime on single payer?
I would like to see Congress get educated about this. I have talked with many people who have gone to town hall meetings and had firsthand discussions with representatives across the country. I can speak mostly to people I know who have done so with Illinois. But one thing that's clear they talk about is just how the Congress people are so, they don't know what the system is. They're not aware of the problems. They're actually ignorant about, I hate to use that word because it's a strong word, but some of the comments that have been made, like nobody has died because they didn't have access. I mean, where does this person live? What bubble are they living in? And that's part of the problem. These congressmen are living in bubbles and have no idea of what everyday people go through just to get their health care needs met. And then there's this other assumption, too, that the biggest driver in terms of health care are poor lifestyles of people. But, I mean, that may be true in the sense that it does lead to more cardiovascular disease. But we have to remember, we are all mortal. We are all going to get sick, whether we lead a perfectly healthy lifestyle or not. So we all are going to need health care.
That's right. Almost all of us will die of disease at some point.
Exactly. Exactly. And even if we die of trauma, I mean, there's still health care in that issue. So the whole idea that staying healthy will prevent you from using health care dollars is a falsehood because we will all eventually need health care. I know very healthy people who have gotten cancer. I know very healthy people who have gotten heart disease. I know very healthy people who unfortunately lived in an area with bad air who ended up with lung disease. So it's not just because of poor lifestyles, because obesity is a big problem. Clearly, that's a factor. I'm not denying that. But that's not what's necessarily driving up healthcare costs.
That sounds like the ever-present factor of prejudice in American political thought.
Well, yeah. It's, you look at the healthcare lobby, it's a huge lobby that has poured millions and billions into congressional races and stuff. And so that's who people are beholden to. And unfortunately, it's been clearly shown that the congressmen are voting for their donors, not for their constituents.
That was Dr. Susan Rogers of Physicians for a National Health Program. Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly recently wrote an article titled "The Democratic Party Death Spiral." Kimberly maintains that the Democrats know what they have to do to win back the presidency and the Congress, that they must support health care for all, higher wages, and affordable education. But the Democrats refuse to do those things because the party is tied to the bankers and the 1%.
It's not hard. You get people to vote for you by telling them that you're going to do something for them. And it's pretty clear what Americans need. The minimum wage is abysmally low. Democrats didn't do anything about it when they controlled Congress those first 2 years of Obama's administration. And some of them parroted the fight for 15, but only after they were out of power and couldn't do anything about it. Bernie Sanders raised issues which, had they been more shrewd, they could have even cynically used to win election, but they were too afraid even to talk about abolishing student loan debt. And forget campaign finance reform. They want no part of that. Hillary Clinton raised $1 billion, and you don't do that by being a reformist. So, yes, they know what to do. Raise wages. Stop the student loan debt. Protect people's homes. For black people, it would be stopping mass incarceration or doing something about police murder. But none of these things are acceptable to the Democrats, or rather acceptable to their patrons. So they use the same terrible losing strategies of hoping that Republicans will be unpopular and they can get back into office that way. That's exactly how Hillary Clinton lost. Donald Trump was supposed to be so terrible that he couldn't possibly win. They didn't even foresee an electoral college win. So they hoped to just repeat what they've done in the past. But Obama, the bloom was off the roads with him. So the hope and change and all the marketing that went into his election and re-election wasn't going to work for Hillary Clinton. And she didn't even, and the rest of the Democratic Party leadership didn't even realize that she was in trouble and that there were states that were in danger of flipping to Trump. So they know what they need to do to get out the votes. It's pretty clear, but they're trying to have it both ways and they can't. They cannot depend on corporate money and do what people want them to do. And consequently, they live in hope that the Republicans will mess up and they can get back in that way.
Yes, it was strange when the Republicans basically got rid of Obamacare. Some Democrats were singing the old song, "Hey, Hey, Goodbye," as if to say, now you're going to lose the next set of elections, as if they were happy with that outcome.
Yes, and as if that's true, that all they have to do is wait for Republicans to make a mistake and they can get back in. But the Republicans, now there's talk of the Senate not even moving on this legislation passed by the House. They're not stupid. So they may not even touch it until after the 2018 elections. And the Democrats could motivate people to vote for them by proposing Medicare for all. Of course, the Republican majority wouldn't let them do it, but propose it anyway and let them shoot it down. And then you could campaign against the Republicans as the people who stood in the way of health care for everyone. But they don't really want that. The purpose of Obamacare was to bail out the big pharma and bail out the health insurance companies who are responsible for the out-of-control costs and the bad outcomes that we have in American health care. It's the profit motive that creates the problem of health care in this country. So they don't want Medicare for all. So the one thing they could do that would perhaps guarantee them victory in 2018 and 2020, they will not do.
In the House, a majority of Democrats has, however, finally endorsed Medicare for All. But Bernie Sanders has still not moved in the Senate with his version of that bill.
Yeah, it's so hard to figure out what he wants. I don't know if he lives in hope that the Democrats will change. I don't know if he's trying to run again. It's hard to say, but it's pretty clear that he does not, I don't believe, deserve the loyalty of the millions of people that he excited, the people who had been disengaged from the system, who were reengaged by his campaign last year. I don't think he's worthy of their loyalty. He has to make up his mind whether he's going to stick with the Democratic Party or not. And it seems that right now he's decided to stick with the Democratic Party, which I argue is on its way out. Who knows how long that will take, but I think they're in a situation where they can only thrive if something very unexpected happens that hurts the Republicans. Otherwise, I don't see a way for them to recover.
Well, there certainly is a huge vacuum in the political landscape. Neither of the bourgeois parties, as we used to call them, has a position that is pro-peace. Both vie for how anti-peace they can be.
Yes, they do, and that includes people like Bernie Sanders, who nibbles around the edges a little bit. But what do they say about America's interventions around the world? They don't oppose it. When Trump sent those missiles into Syria last month, the most that any Democrat would say is that he should have gone to Congress first. They would not say that he should not have done it at all, and that if he really meant what he said during his campaign, that he was not in favor of interventions and regime change, this was a perfect time for him to prove it and disengage the United States from these catastrophes for other people in Iraq and in Afghanistan and in Syria and in Libya and in Somalia and so many other places. If they were a true peace party, that is what they would be saying. But the war party, it's a bipartisan effort of the duopoly.
I think it can be said that Americans are not usually so gung-ho for war, that is, in a permanent gung-ho for war state, but they can be revved up into it. But it seems that the Democrats, especially, in order to maintain this hyper-war mentality, have to claim that the Russians are not over there, that they're over here, messing with the U.S. political system.
Yes, they have to lie. That is the only way to get most in favor of war. So in the case of Syria, you keep saying that the President Assad is a butcher. Democrats keep saying it. The media repeat it. Nobody says that about Saudi Arabia, America's ally, which is bombing in Yemen and has a war strategy of starving people to death. And Syria was attacked by the United States and its allies. People would be living in peace in Syria. They wouldn't have to be refugees. They wouldn't be in danger of starvation were it not for the United States. So they have to lie. And with Obama's popularity among Democrats, who never questioned anything he said, all he had to say that was someone was a despot, was a dictator, and not send Americans to fight, so that many people can be convinced into supporting these interventions. People are more concerned, I think, with their lot here domestically, but with the right propaganda, and that is to say lying, they can be convinced to support crimes committed by their government. As far as Russia is concerned, it's Obama who continued. It's been a policy for 20 years now for the United States to attack Russia in various ways by expanding NATO, by instigating a coup in Ukraine, and with sanctions and so forth. And this campaign scheme of Hillary Clinton's, which was actually based on Marco Rubio's attempt to defeat Trump among the Republicans, was to say that Trump was Putin's puppet, which was not very successful during the campaign because it wouldn't have been so close that she lost in the Electoral College. So this campaign effort has now turned into an effort to help the Democrats avoid blame for the debacle that they created by helping, inadvertently I mean, of course, getting Trump elected with their strategies that I just discussed. So they're trying to avoid blame by saying, we didn't really lose, the Russians put Trump in office. And by the way, there's no proof. There has been no proof that the Russian government hacked the Democratic National Committee. There's no proof of Trump having any dealings with the Russian government. He's hoisted on his own petard a bit with his lying about doing deals in Russia and so forth. But there isn't any evidence and this connection of anybody from Russia with the Russian government. So if, you know, the Trump organization sells condos to rich Russians, we're told that that is proof of Russian involvement in his campaign. So they're trying to kill several birds with one stone. They get to beat up on Trump, avoid blame, and continue war by other means. But it's all very dangerous because they could mess up and cause a real war.
Yes, the former Mayor Bloomberg, who's, I believe, the fifth most wealthy person in the world, would have to bear lots of blame if that's the rationale, since he not only invited all the Russian billionaires into New York City, he celebrated their presence.
Yes, he did. He said, we should be glad that there are billionaires living amongst us when we dare to complain about gentrification, which is a trend, unfortunately, throughout the country, but which Bloomberg really expanded exponentially. So yes, you could say that he was to blame. Every New York City developer, by that standard, is a Russian spy because they love these rich Russians who apparently walk around with suitcases full of money, and if an apartment costs $10 million, they just hand over $10 million. No mortgage, no anything. So then there's lots of Russian spies if we use that very specious reasoning.
So there's no proof of Russian interference in the U.S. electoral system, but it's still an article of faith and one that's repeated and sworn to by virtually all of the black political class, inside and outside of office.
Then that's the saddest thing of all, to see someone like Maxine Waters has been leading this charge. She was, along with other members of the Black Caucus, who were at one time known as the conscience of the Congress, but now they're just party hacks. And they don't even talk about black people very much. I mean, all their statements lately are about Russia and how Trump needs to ask them before he starts a war, not that they are actually against a war. So they are going along to get along. And this is the end result of them being treated like other members, that is to say, targeted by big money and being afraid and not really having the courage of their convictions, assuming they have any anyway. So they sound like the rest of the Democratic Party. And they all, you know, they all threw in their support, except for Keith Ellison. I believe every member of the Congressional Black Caucus endorsed Hillary Clinton. They didn't withhold endorsements. They weren't neutral. They were enthusiastically for her. They didn't question the wisdom of going down this road. And when she lost, that was an opportunity for Democrats to declare, for them to declare their freedom. But instead, they continue to be among the worst hacks in the Democratic Party, and it's very sad to see.
And it goes beyond Democratic Party elected officials. Wade Henderson, who's head of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, just sent out a press release, which was supposed to be about black voter suppression in this country, and yet his lead paragraph was talking about collusion between the Russians and Trump, as if the Russians have something to do with black voter suppression.
Yes, if the Democrats were serious about wanting to get votes, they could make sure that everyone had their voting rights. And in many states, anybody with a felony, and of course that disproportionately affects black people, they're people, if you're convicted of a felony, you essentially lose your voting rights forever. And the Democrats have not spoken about that very much. And it was something that could have gotten them many different victories. So if Mr. Henderson and others are going to talk about black voting rights, they could start right there. And they could also talk about the fact that the voter ID laws and so forth, those are all spreading across the country because Democrats gave up state legislatures. The Republicans, you know, you have to give the devil his due. They think long term. They'll lose a presidential election and then say, well, that's okay, we'll just take over the states. And the Democrats are busy collecting graft and patronage money and didn't care or acted like they didn't care. So these are the causes of the loss of black voting rights. And it's just ridiculous that anybody would say such a thing because no one has said anything about, even the craziest Russophobes have said nothing about the Russian government stopping anybody from being able to vote. But it just shows you the depth of the uselessness of the black misleadership class, that they parrot anything they are told, and they get to keep their good positions, and they get to keep their funding. And it's just an example of why we have to take them on first before we can accomplish anything politically in this country.
You're active in UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, which is having its national conference in Richmond on June 16th.
Stop the wars at home and abroad. That is what UNAC is always discussing. That is our mission. And this conference is going to gather people from around the country and from outside the country to talk about the constant attack on black people through the mass incarceration system, the police state that all black people are living under, the interventions abroad that have brought so much suffering around the world that creates suffering here with this bloated military-industrial complex, which prevents this country from doing the most basic things for its own people. And talking about true resistance and not just being against Trump and not just being Democrats, but talking about how, with a variety of issues, people can coalesce, can be in solidarity with one another to stop all of these violations of our human rights.
Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly. In Philadelphia, we spoke with Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Monteiro, one of the few black public intellectuals that predicted Donald Trump would win last November's election. President Trump has tried to make his peace with the war party by bombing Syria and threatening North Korea, but the attacks on his presidency have only increased.
The fact of the matter is that even in the 56 or so cruise missiles that he launched against Syria and that mother of all bombs that he dropped on Afghanistan in the early part of April, did not fulfill the requirements of the state and the neocons and the party of war. They wanted what Hillary called for right after the bombing, Trump's bombing of Syria, the call for a no-fly zone over Syria and a confrontation with Russia. Let's not forget that in 2016, Hillary and the Democrats were calling for an all-out confrontation with Russia. Trump in the campaign called for the very opposite, including his insistence that he would not support regime change and intervention and nation building. So when he makes what is, in effect, a gesture to get them off of his back in the domestic political struggle, it was not enough. And at this point, I don't think he can ever do enough to satisfy them. However, I think we must be mindful of the fact that we are in the throes of what some people call a soft coup d'etat, what others call a slow coup d'etat, a moving coup d'etat. Trump is targeted to be removed from office, as one commentator said, by any means necessary. So the internal political chaos, and by internal, I'm talking about at the level of political elites, of the governing class, of the neoliberal managerial class, at that level, an intense and deepening struggle is going on and going forward. And Trump's White House is filled with enemies of Trump who are leaking literally everything that goes on in the White House, including in the Oval Office. And he knows that there are very, very few people in the White House or in his administration that he can trust. And finally, I would say, and I think this is something that we have been saying for months now, even if he won the election, the question would be, could he govern and how would he govern? And I think we've seen the answer to that question. He cannot govern. He will not be allowed to govern. And the forces of what we call the deep state, the FBI, the CIA, the national security agencies, the military-industrial complex, the neocons, across the political spectrum, have decided that he must be removed from office, no matter what the consequences of that would be. They feel, I think, that in removing him, no matter what the mass outrage would be, that they would be able to manage that in the end.
Yes, the consequences. About half the country supported Trump. His opponents are not hugely popular among the people. What kind of legitimacy would a post-Trump regime have?
You know, and that's a good question. And I underline the word that you use, legitimacy. And it's, again, something that I have felt for some time, that the nation was in a legitimacy crisis. Even under Obama, the principal institutions of the nation, including the corporate media, the government itself, the Congress, and on down the line, showed very, very low approval ratings. The people were turned off to the governing and ruling institutions of the society. And that explained Trump's victory, by the way. It was, in essence, half the country that participated, or half of those who participated in the election, sent a big no. We reject all of you, and this guy who's saying he's going to clean out the swamp and he's going to take the country in a new direction and literally move back or retreat from empire and war, and they voted for him. Now, could he live up to all of that? We now know he could not. Did he intend to? Perhaps not. But if you take the election as a barometer of what people were thinking and how legitimate the establishment is, and remember, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are quintessentially the establishment. And then when you look at all of the across-the-board support from Wall Street to the corporate media to the FBI and CIA to the military-industrial complex that assembled around Clinton's candidacy, for her to lose represented a profound rejection of the existing order and the existing ruling elite. And that's significant.
There seems to be a perceptive contradiction here. Clearly, Hillary Clinton wanted a continuance and probable escalation of the military offensive that the U.S. has been engaged in since at least 2011. But most people do not associate the Democratic Party as being the party of war.
Well, you know, this is very interesting, what the majority of people associate with what set of political elites. A lot of that has to do with the information they have, that they get, and how things are represented to the masses of people. I think that we're in the throes of a great political moment, a moment of political education of the people. You know, one thing that I think people are beginning to realize, that the Oval Office is not where state power resides, that you can be the president and literally be, and excuse the pun, be trumped by the deep state. That state power, military power, economic power is somewhere else. And the presidents that we elect pretty much are just representatives of one or another faction of the deep state, of Wall Street, of the military-industrial complex. So that's a great political education for the people. And from that, other kinds of understandings flow. For example, what is the difference between the two political parties? What is the difference between Clinton Democrats and, let us say, John McCain Republicans, or Paul Ryan Republicans, or the Republican Party establishment itself? What's the difference between that establishment and the Democratic Party establishment? I think millions, if not tens of millions of people now see that there is no difference. And therefore, they are looking for political leadership to the extent that they're looking to politicians for leadership. They're looking for leadership outside of the two establishments. And in a lot of ways, that explains Bernie Sanders, who is playing a role that is both ambiguous and at times profoundly dishonest, in the sense that he's for war with Russia. He sees Russia as having, quote, hacked our election and our democracy. But at the same time, he's talking about what would be considered radical reforms on the domestic side. Well, of course, you can't have both. War, and King said war is the enemy of the poor. But at any rate, Bernie Sanders is trying to position himself relative to the corporate Democrats, the Hillary Clinton people, if you will, in the ways that Donald Trump positioned himself in relationship to the corporate Republicans in 2016. I think at the end of the day, the era of the two-party system has come to an end. We are entering a new era of American political history. Some would define it in class terms. I would define it in class and race terms, because the system of class and race rule is in profound, deep, and irreversible crisis. And that's what we have to look at as we think about and imagine the future and attempt to come up with tactics and strategies and programs to address the needs of the people.
Sometimes it appears that those forces represented by Hillary Clinton actually believe that the United States can break the Russian government and successfully coerce the Chinese.
Well, that is profoundly delusional. You know, the fact of the matter is that while the West, and the United States in particular, but the entire West, that is the main centers of capitalism and imperialism, while they are in the throes of irreversible political crises, are looking inward, the world is moving forward. And we are moving to the epoch of humanity, away from the epoch of Europe, this 400-500 year moment in history where Europe was the dominant force, the center of history, of world movements in history. We have now moved and are moving to a new epoch. And the symbology of this new epoch are all over the place. For example, more important than the appointment of Robert Mueller as the independent investigator of the so-called Russia-Trump relationship in the 2016 election, that paled into historic insignificance as compared to the meeting in Beijing called by the Chinese government and its president, Xi Jinping, over the question of the One Road, One Belt policy and strategy. I think as many as 28 or 29 heads of state were there, including the Russian president. And what they're looking at is the creation of a new economic, social, political zone, which I like to refer to as the African-Eurasian zone of economic and political relationships. And the first iteration of this is the building of advanced infrastructure that links Europe and Asia and Africa into a great trading zone. But the center is not Europe. The center is Asia. And increasingly, I would suggest Africa. At least 60% of the world's population resides in this zone of human interaction. 60%. But then this is the center of resources, of petroleum. But when you put Southern Africa and Central Africa into this mix, it is the center of the world's resources. But also, when you think about it, it is not a neoliberal globalization centered upon Europe and finance capital. It is a globalization based upon the idea of political equality, of the sovereignty of nations, of the right to self-determination, of the respect for international law, of the repudiation of wars, of suppression and intervention. We are looking at the possibility of a new type of humanity and human relationships away from the system of imperialism and colonialism and neocolonialism to the development of relations between human beings that are predicated upon equality and the right to self-determination and democracy. And thus, I think that this will represent a stimulus that will grow the world economy, which has not really grown for 25 or 30 years. It's been stagnant. This growth will, I think, profoundly affect the African continent, which could see in the not that distant future growth rates of 10, 12% over multiple decades as Africa joins the modern world of technology, of industry, of information and communication, and I would add new ways of powering economic activity that are not based, upon fossil fuels, but upon new technologies of green energy production.
The lords of capital, of capitalism, and their think tankers must understand that the clock is ticking and that the integration and rationalization of the eastern economy and the southern economies spells doom for their hegemony in the world. Could this be why they are so keen for war now?
Well, yes, they are. That's part of it. And they're panicking. They're selling wolf tickets all over the world. But let's look at it. I'm of the opinion that they could not win a war against North Korea. The United States, if that war were to occur, the United States could not win it and would be isolated in conducting it. But the key thing to recognize here is that two of the three largest economies in the world are in that region of the world, in Northeast Asia, China and Japan. Three of the five largest economies in the world are in that region of the world. Of course, when you add South Korea. So a war against North Korea, which would be a war against a highly industrialized and powerful nation in terms of the unity of the people, its military forces and so on, would be tantamount to the United States shooting itself in the head. Similarly, a war with Iran is an unwinnable war, even with the participation of Israel, and even with nuclear weapons as a threat. They couldn't win it. Iran is at a chokehold of the export of petroleum to the world. So a war with Iran would throw the world practically into a recession, if not a depression. So these are wars that the United States can't win. They're wars that the American people pretty much don't want, and they're wars that most of humanity would reject and condemn as acts of aggression. So I think, in spite of the fact that Trump kind of thinks he could sell wolf tickets and win praise from the neocons and the war party, these are hollow threats. The world moves forward. The Beijing summit was the most important event of the year 2017, and the West declines into chaos and political instability and growing class conflict. The rest of the world is looking for ways to create a new world that is not based upon hegemonism and Western domination.
Even here in this country, in the past year, we hear the terminology being used that we didn't used to hear. For example, there was a time when only folks of a very left persuasion used the terms deep state or fascism. Even the term fascism was used mostly by left-wingers. Now it's on everybody's lips. What does this mean?
Well, it's sometimes hard to know what all of it means, because there is political discourse, and then there's irrational political discourse, and then there's completely absurd political discourse, and people are using words and throwing terms at their opponents in order to gain political advantage with no real political or theoretical understanding of what those concepts or terms would mean. For example, take the concept fascism. I am of the opinion, and I think it can be validated, that fascist, if you want to define those who are committed to war and military domination and repression and anti-democracy at home, those people are already embedded in the state. They don't have to come from outside. The 1930s, as an example, the 1930s of Germany, as an example, does not fit the United States. The fascists, or those who are so inclined, already have state power. They don't have to struggle for state power. The question is, can the movements for peace and justice and democracy dislodge the fascists from state power? So for those who made the argument, and now it's now, you know, 100 and some days into the Trump administration, anybody that has the eyes that can see anything know that he did not inaugurate a move to consolidate fascism. The fascists in the deep state are trying to remove him from office. So I think terms like that are used in very unscientific and almost irrational ways, because there is a certain amount of hysteria among liberals and progressives, among the white left in particular, about what the situation is and what the future holds. But of course, emphasis upon the state and the deep state, I think, is a very important turn in public political and intellectual discourse. Of all of the concepts that are thrown around, I think that that is the most important one, because it draws attention to where the real power resides in this country and in most of the West. And it's not in the government, it is in the state. And the state does not have, representatives of the state, I should say, do not have to run for political office. To focus upon the state, if you take it to its logical conclusion, leads us to the conclusion that we really don't have a democracy in this country at all. It is a fake democracy, as fake as the fake news that comes out of CNN and the corporate media.
Ajamu Baraka, who is the Green Party's vice presidential candidate, is pushing something called BAP, the Black Alliance for Peace.
I'm in complete agreement with it. However, with one proviso, I am for a generalized peace movement, a peace movement of all of the people for whom war is an enemy of their class and economic and social interests, and a peace movement of massive proportions would have to be a movement to politically educate the people about the very things that we are talking about here. And I would just address one set of thinkers or actors on the public stage who I think are obstacles to it. And by this, I mean Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! And Noam Chomsky, who have, you know, a real high status among left and progressive thinkers. Noam Chomsky feels that the greatest threat of the Trump administration is their move back from environmental and green concerns. I think that that is a complete displacement of where the real strategic emphasis of progressive and left forces must be. There is a global environmental movement. Trump and his administration will not, cannot dislodge that. That will go forward. The world is conscious of the need to address climate change. However, there is not a world movement, and especially a movement for peace in the United States. In other words, by talking about the environment and not linking it to the immediate priority of building a peace movement against war with Russia, against intervention, what you are doing is, in essence, letting the war makers off the hook. The central political priority right now is peace. Peace and avoiding thermonuclear war and further wars of intervention. The other thing is, the same logic can be heard regularly on Democracy Now! We talk about soft power. Democracy Now! kind of represents the soft left, which in the name of fairness, and I put quotes around that, hears all sides in the left and does not critically expose wrongheadedness in the left, i.e., we're not for war in Syria, but Assad has to go. Well, you can't have it both ways. So I would say that Ajamu Baraka and his colleagues and thousands of people all over this country who are attempting to forge out of the political and intellectual chaos that we see around us are trying to forge a new type of peace movement to challenge this new Cold War and this new McCarthyism. So I think peace is the priority. We must develop a peace movement, and I support everyone who is committed to that, whatever political side they're on.
That was Dr. Anthony Monteiro in Philadelphia. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, recently appeared on Chris Hedges' On Contact program on RT Radio. Abu-Jamal spoke by telephone from the state prison in Mahanoy, Pennsylvania.
America has never come to grips with what a lot of scholars and thinkers call its original sin. And that's because it never stopped happening. Think about this. This country that brags about being founded on freedom was founded on slavery, was founded on Holocaust, was founded on genocide. And after slavery ended, after the Constitution was rewritten and amended, and we had the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, well, what did the South do? They ignored it for a century. You know, there were a few bright years, Reconstruction, and then there was Redemption, where that was destroyed. And it isn't until the 60s that you see this deep, rich emergence of people fighting for rights that were enshrined in the Constitution a century before. That's because every state in the South and many states in the North were allowed to make exceptions to the Constitution. Those exceptions when it came to black people. And we've learned that that's not just the Southern reality. You can't talk about AEDPA, the so-called anti-terrorism death penalty, unless you have the same mindset that makes the Constitution an exceptional document.
In 1968, I think it was, when George Wallace was running for president, he held a rally in Philadelphia, and you were 14 at the time. You attended that rally with three of your friends. And it was out of a Trump rally. Can you explain what took place?
We had the illusion of freedom. So this was our city. We were born and raised there. We went down to what's called the Spectrum. And, you know, like, it sounds silly now, but, you know, imagine five or six, you know, young teenage boys shouting black power in the middle of a Wallace for president. People began spitting at us. People began ripping flags from their sticks and throwing sticks at us and just, you know, just hollering at us and shouting at us. Well, some police came and other security, and they escorted us out. And we thought, hey, well, you know, we had a little fun, and we, you know, our voices were heard, and we went to the bus stop. And two or three of us were on the bus, a young guy named Alvin and a guy named Eddie. And I was like, I'm usually the slowest, so I was behind them. A guy walked up and hit me with a blackjack and knocked me down and pulled Eddie and pulled Alvin off the buses, and we were getting our asses kicked. It never dawned on us that these were cops, because you can't just walk up and beat people up. Well, I remember seeing a cop's leg walk by, and I said, help, help, police. And the guy looked at me, looked down at me, and he walked over and he kicked me right in the face. Then it dawned on me that all of these guys were cops. And that was a little taste of Rizzo, a little taste of Philadelphia, and an introduction to Trump. We see it today. I mean, I can hear Trump saying, you know, yeah, beat the hell out of them. In the old days, well, I lived in those days. They weren't good days. They were ugly days, and they're ugly days today.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.